Okay, I'd like to convene the Ways and Means Committee. We now have a quorum present, and we have the minutes from the previous meeting. Representative Marquardt, I know you were here early. Did you get a chance to look at the minutes?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I'll move those minutes.
Okay, the motion is before us. Any discussion on the minutes? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion carried. We now have House File 80 before us, and this bill we heard the other day. We laid it over, and welcome back, Representative Murphy, and I understand you have an author's amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I do have an author's amendment, A7.
Oh, we need a motion then that we're going to send it right to the floor, right?
I move the A7 amendment.
Okay, we have the motion before us for the A7 amendment. Any discussion? Would you like to explain the amendment, Representative Murphy?
Well, it's a couple of additional things, and it includes the language on corridors of commerce that was adopted in the Transportation Committee last week, and it funds the corridors of commerce, and it makes a change for Anoka County in the city of Ramsey. And Andrew Lee can talk about it in great detail, if you wish.
No, we're fine.
When you say great detail, I'm not sure what the definition of that is, but maybe just a quick recap.
Sure. Mr. Chair and members, Andrew Lee from House Fiscal Staff. If you look at the A7 amendment, the first page, the only new language is on 1.19. This allows the commissioner of MnDOT to use up to 70% of the corridors of commerce authorization for program delivery. Program delivery includes property acquisition, engineering, and design of the roadway projects. And then on the second page and third page is language that allows projects that were selected in either the 2018 project selection that was from the 2017 Corridors of Commerce authorization, and then the subsequent authorization that came in the 2018 bonding bill, that essentially the money for both of those can be used on projects, so that if a project that's that can go forward quicker that was selected on the second authorization of bonds can move forward, but it doesn't add projects. And then I think the last piece is on the fourth page. This is just changing language around an appropriation for a grade crossing in Anoka County, but it doesn't change the amounts. It just changes what the project or what the sort of description of the project.
Okay, any discussion on the amendment? Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's been a few different versions of this corridors of commerce language that have been around. I just want to make sure we have the most up-to-date version that was generated, I believe, from the Department of Transportation. Does the author or Mr. Lee know that we have the right version here?
looking at Deb Dyson from House Research, I believe that's correct.
Thank you.
And Representative Orenstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and Mr. Lee. I just want to make sure that the new language doesn't fundamentally alter or change the intent of what we passed in the Transportation Committee, which is to get this money out to the corridors program, you know, earlier than what was, you know, originally in the bill from last year. So is this pretty much, in your view, reflect our legislative intent in transportation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein, that's correct. This is a similar language, if not identical. It's the same language that what was passed out of the Transportation Committee last week.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Lee.
Okay, any further discussion? Mm-hmm. Now, just as a quick reminder, members, we did hear the bill the other day. It was amended. It was laid over. The bill is now before us again with a new amendment then proposed that we were just discussing, and that amendment has been moved by Representative Olson. So any further discussion on that amendment? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. The bill is now before us as amended. Any discussion? Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My understanding, my apologies for being late. I was down in the Rules Committee. If there's anything you can do in your power as chair to not get the Rules Committee to meet when Ways and Means is meeting, I would certainly appreciate that. That's the third time it's happened so far. So anything you can do to I think you'd have rank in the majority leader, don't you?
Seniority ranking, yes.
Yeah. Okay. And so, Mr. Chairman, is this motion to send it to the General Register?
Yes, that okay. will be the or that is the motion that will be before us. Any further discussion?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I just want to state from my this member's perspective my opposition to passing this bill today on a couple of reasons. The primary one was is that last session we passed a significant reform, and that was to repurpose existing funds for higher priority use than they were being used. Everyone knows that when it comes to wastewater infrastructure, those are critical infrastructure for our state. But when it comes to competing with shiny new things that legislators and the public like, it sometimes falls by the wayside. And so by using those, giving those funds from previous funds that I believe were not appropriately used and, in fact, were wasteful, we gave it a leg up. We were in a position to incentivize and develop that infrastructure more. And now by pulling this into the GO arena, we're kind of going back to square one. And so I just want to state my opposition to that, and would hope that this is something we address before this bill comes up for a vote on the House floor. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, and by the way, when we were dealing with a previous seniority question, it was number of terms. Irv Anderson and I were tied, but his were not consecutive, so technically I had seniority, but those of us that knew Irv Anderson, I did not challenge that question. So at any rate, Representative Olson, would you care to renew your motion?
Yes, I renew my motion
that House File 80, as amended, be recommended to pass and be placed.
What am I doing?
Or that's right, we can't say pass, that's right.
I got sued over that.
Be placed on the General Register.
Mr. Chair, I renew my motion that House File 80 be placed on the General Register.
Now, that motion is before us. And Representative Davids, you have to remember, after 47 years, it's hard to change from placed or from passed to placed. So, but we do try to respect the agreement with the court case and or the settlement, I guess. Did it ever go to court?
No, I was going to win, so you didn't take any further, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. But there was an agreement reached.
Yeah, that's
so,
correct.
So we do say placed. Okay, any further discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion carried. We now have House File 141, Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 141 be recommended to be placed on the General Register.
Well, Representative Poppy, we need the division report first.
Ah.
So that's your motion to adopt the division mm-hmm. report. Mm. She can do that as a member of the committee. Discussion on the division report? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. Now we need the...
Thank you. Now I will
second
move.
Motion. Yeah.
Now I will move House File 141 be recommended to be placed on the General Register.
Okay, that motion is before us. If you could explain the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 141 simply changes the majority of commissioners that need to be in place in order to sell real estate for a port authority. This bill actually has no fiscal impact. It was brought to the Economic Development Committee, it passed out of there, but it is a bill that standardizes the sale of property so that it's the same as a city, a simple majority rather than two-thirds majority which is what currently exists in statute for an economic development port authority. So a number of cities who have port authorities have sought this, and it would standardize the rules for sale, and I'd appreciate your support.
Okay, any discussion? Representative Albright.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair. Question for the author of the bill, Representative Poppe. This bill would affect a number of port authorities, notably, as I see the list that I have in front of me, ones such as St. Paul, Red Wing, St. Cloud, Duluth. One question for you then is, because of the size of the holdings by some of these port authorities, there certainly would arise an issue in terms of, are we talking about a quorum of the board of directors itself, are we present, or are we talking about a quorum, or just more importantly, just half of the members themselves of the membership? The bill seems to be a bit vague on that.
Representative Poppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It is a majority of the Port Authority members.
Mr. Tim Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would the, and this may be a question for you or others, but was there consideration in any committee in terms of whether this change in the Port Authorities would have any effect on the DMC in Rochester?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Albright. I know that that was a question, but it does not appear that it would be a consideration for the DMC in Rochester.
Excuse me, I'm going to turn the chair over to Representative Marquardt. Representative Olson and I will be going down the rules for a few minutes. You probably would like to, yes.
Representative Poppe, did you want to continue? Did you have more on that court? Representative Albright?
Thank you, Chair Marquardt. One of the observations that I've seen and looked at this bill as I read it, that did not have a stop in local government as a subcommittee, and I'm just wondering why.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Albright, the route it took was through economic development. It started in state government. And went to economic development. And now it's here.
Hold on just a sec. Looks like it started in government operations.
Or government operations. Okay. My apologies,
right.
Mr. Chair. Government operations.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
Just in light of the vague, you know, verbiage in this, and I think that with regard to the number of port authorities that are relevant to this type of legislation, I do think it would be very important that this legislation be referred back to local government, the subcommittee on local government. So I would make a motion to re-refer House File 141 back to the subcommittee on local government.
Okay, Representative Albright moves to refer. That be correct, Representative Albright, to the Committee on Local Government.
That is my motion, Mr. Chair.
Hold it. Representative Albright, we do not refer to subcommittees. So if you need to go to the umbrella.
I would
the
refer
umbrella,
them to the Division on Government Operations.
But, all right. So we have a motion to send this back to Committee on Government Operations. Representative Poppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's where it started, was government operations. It did not go to the local government subdivision. It went to government operations and left from there. So, I don't have any opinion. I think it's kind of seen the light of day in a couple of different committees, and it seems to have had the opportunity to be heard and have others have input on it. So I guess I would hope that we could just send it to the floor, but that's up to the committee.
Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, it's obvious from discussion that the intent here is to get it back to local government, to subcommittee, and I think that's absolutely appropriate. We have a number of port authorities around the state. They certainly are directly related to our local governments, and I would speak in favor of the Albright Amendment.
Any further discussion on the Albright motion?
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
Members, the Subcommittee for Local Government was established for the purpose of looking at these bills. Now, whether the assertion to suggest that government operations as a division of ways and means took care of the due diligence on this bill is really not the point. The point is, if it doesn't go to local government, why do you even have a subcommittee on local government if it doesn't deal with these types of issues? People were requested and appointed to that board for the very reason that these types of bills needed to be vetted by them. I understand the author's, you know, rationale of, well, it was seen by government operations, but not everyone on government operations also may serve on the subcommittee on local government. But that's the purpose of subcommittee, is to take a look at these in a fine, granular detail and then make a recommendation up to government operations. So I think it's a straightforward amendment. It does nothing other than vet the bill in a more proper fashion, and it really, I think, justifies the existence of a subcommittee on local government. So with that, I would urge members to approve the motion.
So some of the members who have come into the room from the vote on the Rules Committee, we have a motion to refer this bill to government operations. With the intent then to go to the Division on Local Government.
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
So any further discussion on that motion? Seeing none, I will call for the vote on the motion to refer this bill to government operations. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay.
No.
No. The motion does not prevail. Any other comments on this House file? House file 141. Representative Poppy, do you renew your motion that be recommended that House file 141 be recommended to be placed on the general register?
I do.
All right. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say nay.
No.
A motion does prevail.
Thank you.
Okay, the next presentation is by MMB dealing with the forecast, and we have the commissioner and others could come forward, Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And when I was reviewing my schedule for the week this morning, I realized that this committee and the Transportation Committee are scheduled to meet at the same time tomorrow evening. The Transportation Committee meeting happens to be in Savage, and this committee meeting happens to be here at the Capitol. You're an ex officio member of Transportation, I know that, but there apparently, according to my count, there are five members that are on both committees. I personally take my committee work very seriously. I try to show up at every meeting whenever at all possible and cast a vote whenever anything comes up for a vote. It will be impossible for me and the other members of the other four members of the Transportation Committee to be at two places at once. I think this is very poor scheduling, and I'm frankly very disappointed that they would your party would schedule two important meetings at the same time in different cities.
Okay, your point is made. This committee as you know, can meet at the call of the chair. We're getting close to deadlines, and it's a very busy period of time. I don't know if when your folks were in the majority, if you had a committee meeting in two different locations, but at any rate, I do know firsthand that there were sometimes conflicts when we got close to the deadlines where more than one committee would be meeting at the same time. But your point is well taken, and we will be meeting tomorrow night. And I think, by the way, being that the question is before us, I have requested a room change, and we will post that as soon as possible. I would prefer to meet in this building rather than in the Capitol for convenience. Now, Savage will be a little different question, but the community of Savage. But at any rate, it would be a little more convenient for some that might have to shuttle back and forth if we meet in this building. And so we're looking for space here, and we'll announce that as soon as possible. Representative Torkelson?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I still don't think I'll be able to quite make it. It's a little bit closer, but not quite close enough. I don't recall, in my 10 years here at the legislature, I don't recall having two committee meetings scheduled at the same time in different cities. I just, maybe it's happened, but I, you know, it's hard for me to remember all 10 of my years, and there are other members that have been here longer than I have. Certainly you've been here a lot longer than I have. Perhaps you recall a time when two important committee meetings were scheduled at the same time in different cities.
Representative Torkelson, as I mentioned earlier, I don't offhand recall. I suspect in 47 years it may have happened, but I can't speak, with any firm answer to that particular question. But I do know that, generally speaking, there are at times conflicts. Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the meeting tomorrow night, the one that's in St. Paul, we have an opioid bill up. We have another bill up. Are there fiscal notes currently on either of those? And if not, when should will we have them by meeting time?
The one bill will have a spreadsheet available, which is what we sometimes do in Ways and Means. That will be the opioid bill. We should have a fiscal note available for the other bill as well.
Thank you.
Yeah. There haven't been, by the way, that'll be the original fiscal note. There haven't been any changes in that bill that would have a cost factor, as I understand it. So the fiscal note that's online would be the one that we'll be using before the committee tomorrow night. Okay, any further questions? Representative Groffel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the Representative Torkelson, that is that meeting tomorrow? Is that Representative Tapke's district? Do you know?
I don't know.
Whose district? Do you know, Mr. Chairman, staff, do you know whose district that is?
Maybe Representative Orenstein is the chair of the committee that's going to be meeting in Savage. Perhaps he knows the answer to the question.
Mr. Chair, it's I believe that Representative Cantrell represents Savage.
Okay, that's good. Mr. Chairman, I don't know to staff who care. There are, I guess, there's worse things than a bunch of Republican legislators going into a first-term DFLers district. In fact, a little history is that two of our candidates that I recruited to run for the legislature were during DFL committee hearings that were taking place in those districts. That's how we ended up with Representative Tim Kelly and another representative who will name nameless. So maybe if you're forced to go down to Savage, you'll spend some extra time down there. I'm sure we can meet some good people. It's worked in the past.
Representative Torkelson, let's not go overboard on the politics of where the meeting is.
There's a lot of meetings taking place in first-term DFL districts, and that's fine if that's the call the majority wants to play, but it hasn't worked out too well in the past. But it's you guys run the place. It's up to you.
I was just saying we don't need to debate the politics of the location of – or the location of the meeting was a fine question. I respect the point that Representative Torkelson was making. At any rate, it is a busy time, and that's what happens. And I think that do you have Representative Hornstein bills that are up in the committee, or is it informational? I should know because I am an ex-official, but I haven't looked.
Mr. Chair, there's two bills that we won't be taking action on. the purpose of these field hearings is to hear from the public in communities that are in and around our members' districts.
Okay, so you do have two bills that will be be up in.
And Mr. Chair, we've had several meetings that have, you know, committee meetings that have taken place at the same time outside of the Capitol. And, you know, members just need to make their decisions based on their priorities.
Okay, Representative Torkelson, and then we're going to move on for the testimony on the forecast.
Well, very quickly, Mr. Chair, thank you. Just a couple of points. I want to thank Representative Garofalo for helping me try to decide which meeting might be more important to me. But second, we have a total of five off-site hearings in the Transportation Committee in these few weeks. It's been an extremely busy schedule, demanding. All of our committee members have had to travel to various cities and give up our Fridays. I think this will be the third one, if I remember correctly, coming up this Friday in Mankato. And you're right, this is a very busy time. And to keep dragging us all over the state for these meetings, while I love hearing from all these various constituents in these various districts, it does seem to be interfering with our work here at the Capitol, Mr. Chair.
Okay, with that, if you would care to begin, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Myron Franz, Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget. I'm here with the state economist, Dr. Laura Klumbakidis, and Budget Director Britta Ray-Tom. I'll make a few opening remarks. We'll go through a slide deck for your review, and then we'll open it up for questions. But I'll just make a couple opening comments and then turn it over to Budget Director Ray-Tom. As you know, last Thursday, we issued a new forecast with a balance of $1.052 billion for the 20 and 21 biennium. This budget balance is $492 million less than the November forecast, which, as you will all recall, was $1.544 billion. Now, our forecast has been lowered because we've reduced our revenue projections over the next 4 years. We made this reduction in revenue projections because we were forecasting a reduction in economic growth in the future, and we have seen a reduction in actual revenue receipts since November. As a result, our budget outlook has weakened since November. Today's forecast, with a balance in 20 and 21 of 1.05 billion dollars, is in addition to our revenue reduction projections, we are also projecting some reduction in spending that will offset some of this reduced revenue, but not all of it. So I'll turn it over now to Budget Director Ray-Tom to go through the first slide.
Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
Identify yourself for the record.
I'm Britta Ray-Tom, State Budget Director. And on this first slide that I'll walk through, this is the budgetary balance in the current biennium since the November forecast. As you can see in the lower right corner of the slide, the overall budgetary balance in fiscal years 18 and 19 has declined by $157 million since November. Revenue estimates have decreased by $198 million, and expenditure estimates have also declined by $41 million. There's no change in the budget reserve in this forecast. The budget reserve balance remains at $2.075 billion, and the cash flow account remains at $350 million, for a total of $2.425 billion in both the cash and budget reserves. There's also no change to the previous forecast in the stadium reserve, which remains projected at $50 million by the end of fiscal year 19. The changes in revenues and expenditures leave us with an estimated balance of $563 million, which is available to balance forward into the next biennium. The amount of the balance forward, as I mentioned earlier, has declined by $157 million compared to our November forecast. So turning to the next slide, this provides the updated budgetary picture for fiscal years 20 and 21. And this is where you can see the $1.052 billion that's now projected to be available for the upcoming biennium. Walking through the numbers, you can see that the beginning balance declines by the $157 million that I walked through on the previous slide. The revenues have decreased by $386 million compared to our previous forecast, and expenditures have declined by $51 million. And again, there's no change in the cash and budget reserves or the stadium reserves relative to our previous forecast. However, I want to note that the stadium reserve is still projected to grow by $48 million compared to the current biennium, reaching $98 million by the end of fiscal year 21. The changes in the beginning balance, revenue, and expenditures lead to an overall reduction since November of $492 million. We'll provide further detail on the drivers of the expenditure changes and the revenue changes a bit later, but for now I'll hand it over to Dr. Columbakidis to walk through the economic outlook.
Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Laura Columbakidis, the state economist. I'm going to start by talking a bit about the outlook for the U.S. economy, then I will, and how that outlook has changed since we last produced a forecast. Then I'll move to Minnesota's economy, and last I'll talk about changes to the revenue forecast. So the first chart shows annual real GDP growth, both the history, so the dark bars show the history from the Great Recession until now, and the current forecast by Minnesota's macroeconomic consulting firm IHS. And then the gray bars show their November forecast, the one that informed our November outlook. So in this chart, if you focus first on years 2018 to 2020, you can see that the near-term outlook for U.S. economic growth, especially this year, 2019, has weakened since our forecast was last prepared in November. Lower estimates of growth at the end of 2018 led IHS to lower their expectations for this year's real GDP growth from 2.7% in November's outlook to 2.4% now. They also lowered their 2020 forecast from 2% from 2.1%. Their outlook for growth in 21 and 22 is slightly higher than in November. Now, if you look at the current forecast for 18 through 23, so the dark bars on the right-hand side of the chart, that downward step pattern, you can see that the pattern of slowing growth through our planning horizon carries over from the prior forecast. So we had that same pattern in November, that slowdown. While current conditions can support moderate growth for much of this year, IHS expects the economy to begin slowing in late 2019. This occurs for a number of reasons that are actually similar to the reasons that we had that slowdown in the November forecast. That is, the contribution to growth from federal fiscal stimulus declines, monetary policy becomes more restrictive, global growth weakens, and a strong U.S. dollar relative to trading partners' currencies pulls down net exports. And in addition to that, and this was also in the November forecast, after mid-2020, IHS expects a demographically driven decline in the U.S. labor force participation rate, and that will slow the economy even more. So that demographic change is as the baby boom population aging out of the workforce. The downshift continues, with annual real GDP growth expected to decelerate from 2.9% last year to less than half that rate in 23. And then the history on the chart, so the dark bars to the left of the forecast, the years since the recession, illustrates one of the risks to the forecast. And I've shown you this chart before. That dotted line is at 3.1%. That's the average annual real GDP growth for the 20 years prior to the Great Recession. And that rate, of course, is much higher than what is in our current forecast. And when the economy grows more slowly, there's not much margin for error. It's harder to recover from a setback than when growth is higher. And U.S. expansion is expected in a few months to break the record for the longest expansion set in the 90s. So as you can see in this graph, all of the years of our forecast have positive real GDP growth. So the economy, the U.S. economy, continues to grow here. So they are indeed, IHS is indeed forecasting that the U.S. expansion will break that record this summer. And a mature low-growth expansion is particularly vulnerable when negative shocks occur. The next chart compares Minnesota's labor market performance to the nation's. So this chart shows the headline unemployment rate, that top line overall unemployment rate. The dark line is for Minnesota, and the light line is for the United States. And, of course, the vertical gray bars show the U.S. recessions. So Minnesota's steady economic performance continues, even as that the U.S. expansion, as I said, approaches record length. But the state's ability to add jobs appears to be reaching the limit set by slow labor force growth. And this is slow labor force growth that has been long forecast due to the aging of the population. Throughout the expansion, Minnesota has steadily added jobs, driving the state's unemployment rate well below the U.S. rate. Our unemployment rate currently stands at 8%. That's between the low points of the prior two expansions. So you can see that it is 0.2 or 0.3, 3/10 of a percentage point above the lowest point of that record expansion. It's more than 1 percentage point below the U.S. rate, half a point below last year, the seventh lowest among states and the lowest we've seen in 18 years. The next chart illustrates another aspect of Minnesota's tight labor market. And this is another one that that you've seen before, but I think it makes a nice illustration of our labor market in Minnesota. The gray bars show the number of unemployed people in the state. So the height of the gray bars is the number of unemployed people, so that the number that's related to the rate that you saw in the prior chart. And the dark bars, the height of the dark bars, shows total job vacancies across the state. So in the height of those gray bars, you can see the peak of unemployment during the recession, and you can see how that steady job growth that we had during this recovery has gradually whittled that number down. And then the dark bars show that job vacancies statewide have grown to a very high level. The ratio of unemployed persons to job vacancies statewide has been less than one over the past year and is now down to about 0.7. And that ratio is less than one, so illustrating a tight labor market and more more job vacancies than unemployed job seekers. That ratio is less than one, both in the metro area and in greater Minnesota right now. The large number of open positions across the state illustrates a strong demand for labor, and we expect that to persist. But as retiring baby boomers dampen growth in Minnesota's workforce, our ability to continue to add jobs is increasingly constrained, and employers and job seekers must become ever more creative to match people to jobs. As employers and job seekers adjust to this environment, Minnesota's labor market appears to be slowing down. Since last August, the unemployment rate has held steady at 2.8%, so it's held steady there and hasn't gone further down. And between 2011 and 2017, Minnesota employers added, on average, 42,000 new jobs a year. So a job addition in this context means not an open vacancy, but a position that has a person in it. So you need a person in the job to count it as a new job. So that annual average was 42,000, but in the 12 months ending December 18, employers added a little more than half that many. So that number is subject to revision. That could change, but it also could signal that we are feeling the impacts of that constrained labor force. And one important way this feeds into our tax revenue forecast is through our forecast of total Minnesota wage and salary income. So what I mean by total wage and salary income is as if you added up all of the payrolls of all of the employers for the entire state, and then we are estimating how that number grows over time. We continue to expect that number, total wage and salary income, to grow each year, but we now expect weaker growth than we expected in November. The forecast reduction is due to a number of things. It's due to a downward revision to 2018 employment. So employment numbers that we had in November, those numbers have been revised down relative to 2018, so those smaller job gains I mentioned. It's due to lower than expected wage income growth last year. So the economic data on wage income growth for 2018 came in lower than the information that we had in November. Recent weakness in income tax withholding receipts. So careful readers of our revenue reports will notice that income tax withholding has come in short of our forecast since November. And a lower forecast for U.S. wage income for IHS. So IHS also lowered the forecast for that total wage and salary income number for the United States, and that feeds into our forecast as well. So all of that is happening, and then as a result of slowing employment growth that I talked about, more of Minnesota's growth in total wage income is expected to arise from higher earnings per worker and less from increases in the number of people working. So that total payroll number, that can grow if we add more people to the into employment, or it can grow if the number, if wages per worker goes up, or if both of those go up. So what's happening in our forecast is that more of the growth in total wage and salary income comes from our expectation of higher wages, earnings per worker, rather than increases in the number of people working. So moving to the revenue forecast, on this table, the first two columns show the current forecast and the forecast change for the current biennium, 18-19. And the right two columns show the current forecast and the forecast change for the next biennium. Total general fund revenues for the 18-19 biennium are now forecast to be $198 million less than the November forecast. Lower expected individual income and sales tax revenue more than offsets higher forecasts for corporate and other tax revenue. As you can see, the highest dollar amount change in the current biennium forecast is in the individual income tax, which is forecast to generate $403 million less in the remainder of fiscal year 19 than we had estimated in November. So far in this fiscal year, again, for careful readers of our revenue reports, net income tax receipts are below our prior forecast. Those lower revenues and lower forecast income growth, including that wage and salary income growth that I mentioned, contribute to the reduced income tax forecast. Sales tax revenue for 18-19 is now forecast to be $19 million less than the November forecast. The lower revenue forecast is primarily due to lower forecast growth in taxable Minnesota sales. So when we construct a sales tax forecast, what we do is we look at the U.S. forecasts for spending, consumer spending in lots of consumer and business spending in lots of different spending categories. And then we construct a proxy sales tax base for Minnesota based on all those spending categories that we tax. And then we look at how that proxy base grows over time. And in this forecast, that tax base grows more slowly than what we had estimated in November. And that's consistent with the lower U.S. economic forecast I showed in that first slide. So that's where that comes from. The corporate revenue forecast is up $130 million, primarily due to higher-than-expected receipts so far this fiscal year. The Federal Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017 made some big changes to corporate tax law, and businesses had to decide how to respond to that law. For example, some of the higher-than-expected corporate tax collections we've seen so far this fiscal year may have been due to corporations shifting the timing of their income to take advantage of the lower federal corporate tax rate in 2018, and not due to higher corporate tax liability. We had to make estimates of how much of this revenue is due to income shifting and how much is actually a higher base of liability from which to start our forecast. So those estimates introduced risk to our revenue forecast. The forecast change for the next biennium, so the right-hand two columns, shows a similar pattern to the current biennium. Lower forecast individual income and sales tax revenues more than offset higher forecasts for corporate and other taxes. And that lowers the revenue forecast for 20 and 21 by $386 million. And the dynamics of the forecast are similar in this biennium. Lower starting points for the income and sales taxes, so lowering the current biennium lowers the starting point for the next biennium. And those lower starting points combined with lower growth in taxable income on the income tax side and lower taxable sales growth on the sales tax side to reduce the 2021 income tax sales tax forecasts. And a higher starting point for the corporate tax forecast raises our expectations for 20 and 21 corporate tax receipts. So if you'll recall that step down in economic growth that we showed in the U.S. economic forecast, we also have a deceleration in total revenues over the three biennia included in this forecast. Revenues are still growing across the years of the forecast, but the pace of growth is slowing. So on the chart, we illustrate that between the last biennium and the current one, total revenues grow 2% per year. That rate falls to 3% between the current biennium and the next, and falls again to 2.3% between 20 and 21 and 22-23. Budget Director Raton will talk about the impact of that revenue slowdown on the state structural balance. And then let me conclude by drawing your attention to some of the risks to the forecast. The Federal Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 17 made some big changes to federal tax law. Individuals and business owners had to decide how to respond to that law. But because we haven't seen tax returns from 18 yet, we're still dealing with uncertainty about how taxpayers actually did respond to those changes and how their choices will affect or are affecting estate tax revenues. The uncertainty about corporate tax receipts that I mentioned earlier is one example that introduces risk to the forecast. Minnesota's employment gains appear to be increasingly constrained by slow labor force growth. And that slowdown is baked into our current forecast. So that slowdown is in here. But if labor force growth grows even more slowly than we expect, our employment forecast is at risk. And our forecast of total wage and salary income, a key factor in the income tax forecast, remember I said that depends on continued demand for workers leading to higher earnings per worker. So that creates some risk. And this forecast regarding the U.S. outlook, this forecast assumes that all of the U.S. tariffs and other countries' retaliatory measures that have been put in place in the last year are permanent. But as you know, U.S. trade policy, especially regarding China and the new NAFTA agreement, has been in flux. Prolonged uncertainty imposes costs on businesses that have to address supply chain disruptions, and they may put investment on hold, and that will affect GDP. Geopolitical events can derail global growth that is already showing signs of slowing. So I said baked into this forecast is slowing global growth, but unexpected geopolitical events can disrupt that. For example, if the UK exits the European Union without an agreement, a disruption to exports can follow. And then finally, with 28 months before the end of 20 and 21, we have not yet seen any of the total revenues we forecast for those years. Even small changes to assumed growth rates and particularly volatile income sources such as capital gains or corporate profits could materially alter the budget picture into our planning horizon. So I'll turn it over to Budget Director Britta Raytheon.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Moving to the next slide, this is a look at the expenditure side of the forecast. Expenditures are down relative to our previous forecast in each biennia. This slide focuses on the change in fiscal years 20 and 21. The overall change in expenditures is quite small, just 0.1%. E-12 education expenditures are down $48 million from our previous forecast. This is due to lower actual student counts and lower free and reduced lunch concentration rates. That reduction is partially offset by increases in special education aid, and the change overall in E-12 education since our previous forecast is less than 0.2%. Property tax aids and credits have increased relative to the November forecast by $29 million in fiscal years 20 and 21. And this is largely due to growth in property tax refunds for homeowners. This increase is based on an increase in the actual payments made to homeowners this year, as well as slower projected income growth assumptions into the future. Health and Human Services expenditures are forecast to be $30 million or 0.2% lower in the next biennium compared to our previous estimates. Medical assistance spending is up $13 million from the previous forecast and is driven by higher spending in long-term care programs. And that increase is offset by $43 million in lower-than-expected spending in other forecast program areas, the biggest of which is chemical dependency, which has a lower spending amount of $32 million. Debt service and all other categories are unchanged from the November forecast. And then moving to the next slide, this chart provides a look at the planning estimates in fiscal years 22 and 23 and shows the structural balance between revenues and expenditures in both the fiscal years 20 and 21 biennium and the 22-23 biennium. That means it removes from the chart the impact of balance forwards and changes to reserve levels. And you can see in this chart that the structural balance declines into the planning years, and on a structural basis, the number is actually very slightly negative in fiscal years 22 and 23. That's that negative $11 million. I also want to highlight that this view is representing just the structural balance in the general fund. Not included in this total is the projected deficit in the healthcare access fund. With the expiration of the provider tax, the healthcare access fund is now projected to have a $919 million deficit in fiscal years 22 and 23. Also on the far right side of the chart, you can see the projected annual growth rates of spending and revenues between fiscal years 2021 and 22-23. Spending in the general fund grows over this period at 2.9% annually, which exceeds the 2.3% annual growth in revenue, and that's that same 2.3% that Dr. Columbakidis referenced earlier. The biennial growth shown here in the expenditure side is just growth that's occurring within forecast programs, and the biggest driver of that growth is medical assistance. And as you know, inflation is generally not included in the expenditure estimates in the forecast, except in programs where there is an inflationary component built into the formula, where there's either an inflationary factor applied to the appropriation or where it's based on actual cost. Some examples include property tax refunds, special education, a portion of health care, and debt service. Those would have some inflationary measure baked into our estimates going forward. So the estimate of inflation we provide is just a calculation that's on all other programs and all other spending that doesn't already have an inflationary component. And we use the Consumer Price Index to provide that inflationary estimate. And then it compounds over 2 years in 2021 and over 4 years in 22 and 23, which is why that 22-23 number is so much larger. So the numbers at the bottom of the slide just provide some context for the pressures on the expenditure side that are not built into the forecast. Now I'll hand it back to Commissioner Franz.
Okay, and I don't know how many questions there may be, but if all three of you are perhaps at the table, that would be fine. Commissioner, did you have a wrap-up before we take questions?
Mr. Chair, members, yes, I would just like to make a couple comments on this last slide, then we can open it up for questions, as you suggest. As you can see from this this slide, this shows you the current status of our budget reserve and our cash account, which total now $2.425 billion. We put $491 million into the reserve fund in the November forecast, and although we're not quite at 100%, we're very close to it. So one of the things I just wanted to mention as we go into this this budget year in the legislature is that we do have a budget balance in 2021. It's been reduced some, and we have a challenge in the 22-23 arena for planning. But we do run it. We go into this budget year with a balanced budget, with a AAA credit rating, with adequate resources in the future if we have an economic downturn. And the governor, and I'm sure many of you, would also recommend that this budget reserve be not be spent during this budget cycle and to be maintained for any economic downturn, which we're not seeing. We are seeing a slowdown in growth, but not an economic downturn. So with that, we'd be happy to take your questions, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
We have a couple of people already. Now we're up to three. Representative Ruffle.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If it's okay, I just have a couple of questions. Is that all right?
No, that's fine.
Thank you.
That's why I called you on it.
Thank you. First of all, I'm assuming, Doctor, that in the unemployment rate that we're seeing there, it's the U3 unemployment rate. Is that correct?
Yeah. Or no, it's U2. It's the whatever the most general one is. So I think that's U2.
Mr. Chairman and to the doctor, would it be possible to get that graph laid out with the U6 unemployment rate? Is that available to us?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is available, and that is available from DEED. So Department of Employment and Economic Development produces a report that keeps it up to date called Alternative Measures of Unemployment, I think, or Alternative Measures of Labor Underutilization, and that includes the U6
measure. Mr. Chairman, to the testifier, so it lays it out comparable, the exact way that yours is laid out here, where it compares it to national data and tracking historically?
Dr. Kolumbakidis?
Mr. Chair, Representative, no. What DEED's report does is it compares all the different measures of unemployment for Minnesota, so U3, U4, U5, U6. So it, and for people who are unfamiliar with those terms, the high U6 would be a level of unemployment that includes not just the people who are defined as unemployed in the overall measure, but people who are marginally attached to the workforce, meaning that they are they're not currently working, but they're also not looking for work. And so those people are added in, and then the U6 gets all the way to adding in people who are working part-time but would prefer full-time work, so those people working part-time for economic reasons. So the DEED report shows those measures for Minnesota. We can tell you what the numbers are for the United States versus Minnesota.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, that would be helpful if you could just share with, or I don't know if you want to share with the staff, and then they can distribute to the committee, the U6 data historically, just basically the exact same data you laid out in your report, just with the U6 measurement, and share it with staff to distribute to the committee. That would be helpful. Thank you. My next question is with regards to the assumptions of the tariffs that are occurring. And I know this is in your report, but we should just restate for members of the committee. Those tariffs, number one, who pays those? When the United States government levies tariffs on Chinese imports, number one, who pays those tariffs? And number two, does that have a net positive or negative or net negative impact on the economy in the United States?
Dr. Kolumbakidis.
Mr. Chair, Representative, members of the committee. So as a general rule, when the U.S. imposes tariffs on goods that are imported from other countries. It's the importer who pays, who remits the tariff to the United States government. And so that means that Chinese goods that are coming into the United States, whoever's importing them into the United States, they're paying that tariff. And that, so that's the, that's who's writing the check or sending the money. Then what happens to that, you know, that impact, it depends on what then happens to those goods. So if someone is importing final goods, goods that are finally for consumers, so, you know, clothing or some, or electronics or something that are then going to be sold to consumers, that tariff might be passed on from the importer to the consumer. When the tariff is on intermediate goods, so these are goods that a U.S. manufacturer is going to use to make a final good for consumer, then what that tariff does is it increases the costs for the manufacturer. And so, because they're now paying a tariff on those imported goods, and so then they have to decide, they also have to decide whether they can pass that forward completely to consumers or whether that passes back to their profits or whether it changes the wages, lowers the wages that they pay to their workers. It's also possible that on the other side of the ocean that the exporter negotiates a deal with the importer to absorb some part of that tariff on their end, but for the most part, that gets passed passed on to the importer. The impact on the U.S. has been I don't have a measure of that, you know, in terms of, you know, percentage points on GDP, but it has overall been negative because it. It's, you know, it's increasing prices to consumers. It's increasing costs to businesses. But it's also the fact that, as I said in my opening remarks, that when trade policy is in flux and when it's changing like this, businesses are trying to decide, what am I going to do? Am I going to accept that increased cost on my intermediate goods, or am I going to try to find a U.S. provider, and is that U.S. provider going to be able to ramp up or not, and is it going to cost me more? And so they may be holding off on investment until this settles down, and that that can slow economic growth.
And Mr. Chairman, my final question, on the handouts that's before us on page... Page 10, the top line item there is taxpayer response to federal tax law changes in terms of forecast risks.
Mm-hmm.
And that can, whenever we have major tax reform at the federal level, of course, there's an infinite number of ways that that can impact individual states and state resources. I want to specifically talk about the state and local tax deduction and the $10,000 cap that was put in place at the federal level.
Mm-hmm.
So again, I'm aware of the fact that people are accelerating their charitable contributions into a 3-year gift and then taking the standard deduction in later years. I'm aware of other strategies that people are doing. I'm specifically focused on this $10,000 cap on state and local taxes. And my question for you is that, in your opinion, do you believe that that tax change is providing a financial incentive for wealthy taxpayers to leave the state of Minnesota?
Dr. Paul Mikitas.
Mr. Chairman, representative, members of the committee, what the cap on state and local tax deductions did was it made those taxes a little more expensive for people who no longer can take the deduction because they're not getting the benefit of that federal deduction on their state and local taxes. So if state and local taxes were figuring heavily in their decision making to the point where a marginal change like that can tip the balance of a decision, then it may be changing decisions for people. But I have no direct evidence of an exodus as a result of this, that it would be early for that to be happening. But indeed, what it did was it made Minnesota taxes more expensive.
And Mr. Chairman, and to the doctor, you said the term, it made taxes, quote, a little more expensive for those ratepayers. My understanding is their income tax liability went up anywhere from, on that portion of their losing that deductibility, their taxes went up anywhere from 25 to 35%. That every single dollar above $10,000, if they're in the 39.6 tax bracket, that is a dollar in increased federal taxation. And that sounds like a lot more than a little more. And this is these questions are kind of meant to be a little bit of a softball because you'll notice I'm not hammering on the Dayton tax increase of 2013, which is the basis for these SALT changes. You know, the governor of New York is in a similar situation to us, and he's making radically different comments about what effect this $10,000 cap is having on wealthy taxpayers fleeing his state. And he has radically different comments about how important it is for the federal government to review that legislation. And he is citing that the reason why New York has had such a dramatic reduction in their income tax revenue is as a result of this federal tax change. So can you comment on that?
Dr. Cohen-Bakidis?
Mr. Chair, Representative, just to be clear so that everybody's on the same page here is that we're talking about changes in your marginal tax rate, which means as you said, the tax on an additional dollar of revenue or additional revenue. So when you talk about changes, you know, changes in the marginal tax rate of 25%, I want to make sure people don't think that that means on 25% increase on your overall taxes. Okay, because that I'm not saying that you confused it, but other people that does get confused often that we mean on all of your taxes, but it's a progressive tax system. So indeed, I simply can reiterate what I said, which is that yes, this made state and local taxes more expensive for people who lost that deduction and used to get it in the past. And that may be changing people's decisions on the margin.
And Mr. Chairman, into the doctor, and changing those decisions on the margin, would it be changing them in a positive way to encourage people to go to places like Minnesota and New York, or be changing them in a negative way to discourage them or encourage them to leave places like Minnesota and New York?
Dr. Cohen-Bakidis.
So it makes the taxes more expensive. And so if taxes are a big part of your decision of where you're going to work and where you're going to live, then having that become more expensive can tip the balance for you. The decision of where to live, we know from research that the decision of where to live, where to start a business, where to raise a family, encompasses lots of things besides the state tax rate. Or the impact of the federal taxes on you. So there are a lot of things that go into that decision.
And Mr. Chairman, this is something that I originally highlighted. I highlighted for the committee back in 2018. This is a really big deal, and it was not done by accident by our friends in Washington D.C. This change in tax law was meant to do one of two things. It was either A, to encourage places like Minnesota, Oregon, Illinois, and New York to change our tax laws from taxing savings and investment and moving to a more consumption-based tax. Or, if we didn't do that, it was to provide financial encouragement for wealth to flee these high-tax communities. And I got to tell you, it's working. It's working like a charm. And it's something that I think our state is going to be having to deal with in the years ahead. This is a very big issue. If you think about just the fact of a person who has $10 million of taxable income right now, you know, they used to be able to write off about $1 million in state and local taxes. And that's not even factoring in, you know, property taxes. And now that's been cut to $10,000. That's $1 million of lost deductions at a, you know, 35-39% rate. You're talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars, where in the past the federal government has essentially allowed a subsidy for those high rate payers, and they've taken it away. Now, whether this policy was a good idea or a bad idea, I understand reasonable people can disagree on these issues. You know, a place like state of Washington doesn't have an income tax. Their taxpayers can't write off that tax burden. A place like Oregon to the south has a high income tax. Their residents are able to write it off. And I understand reasonable people disagree on it, but what my concern is that there seems to be a level of denial from the other side of the aisle, this is actually taking place. candidly, I don't care who you blame. What is happening is this is provided a by the elimination of a federal subsidy for high-income tax states, it is providing a financial incentive for high-wealth individuals, high-wealth businesses to leave our state. And we need to get in front of this and start doing something about it rather than reacting to it. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We have to be out of here in 20 minutes, and we have now on the list 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 people that have indicated they have a question. And if folks can, and I gave you quite a bit of latitude as the minority lead, but if people can be short and concise with their questions to respect the opportunity of others to ask. The next person on the list is Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have a question. Before I do, I just like to kind of comment on what I just heard a little bit, and I think that it's interesting that Representative Garofalo is basically admitting that the Republican Congress either tried to coerce or to punish Minnesota with the tax bill. I mean, that's kind of the way you've stated it. I think that's probably true. But I also just want to say that New York is, I think, had or is having a big snowstorm. And we've sure had a little snow this year. So I don't know how you figure out when, you know, especially as the population ages, of course, we have more people that move to warm places. And this winter, unfortunately, may tip a few who were maybe going to stick it out longer. So we'll see. I think it's kind of hard to sort those things out sometimes. Anyway, my question had to do with the what I heard when we were talking about the planning estimates. I don't know if it was the budget director who was talking about it, this page, page 12 in our handouts, and mentioned that the in 22-23, the Health Care Access Fund would be in deficit by $919 million. And I just wanted to ask, since there are expenses right now that are being paid out of the Healthcare Access Fund, ongoing expenses, does this budget reflect those expenses? You know, you have projected spending here, $50 billion, but does that include the at least $800 million in Medicaid expenses that are right now being paid out of the Healthcare Access Fund? And other things as well that are ongoing expenses that are paid out of that fund. When the fund goes away and goes into deficit, where in the forecast do we see those expenses?
Commissioner Breton?
Mr. Chair and Representative, we are still reflecting the expenditure side of the Healthcare Access Fund obligations in the Healthcare Access Fund, and that's what drives the deficit. So they are not being reflected in the general fund expenditures. They're being reflected in the Healthcare Access Fund. Our definition of base in current law is that we assume that the base amount continues forward, that the 2021 amount continues forward into 22 and 23. And so we applied that definition when we constructed the Healthcare Access Fund statement, so those expenditures remain in the Healthcare Access Fund. But without additional revenues in that fund, we will need to confront what happens, especially to those medical assistance spending obligations, which is 7.7% of medical assistance is paid out of the Healthcare Access Fund currently.
All right. So, Madam Chair. Representative Lee. Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and just thank you. Thank you for that information. Just to kind of put a point on it for members that, you know, just because it's, you know, in a different fund – doesn't mean that this isn't a very serious future hit to our budget if we just allow a lot of revenue to disappear that we currently have coming into the fund. So this is very serious. I don't know how in the future we will construct our budgets without this money coming in. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Liebling, for that. And, you know, the Healthcare Access Fund is paying a lot of different things. And as a matter of fact, in the past has become a laundromat around this place where transparency has suffered. And so I would hope at some point we can
bring that health care access fund into the general fund and put them together so that we are talking clearly about our planning and to Minnesotans generally. But my question is either for the commissioner or budget director Ratan, and that is about the last slide in the presentation, and that is the $2.4 billion in budget reserve and cash flow monies. It appears, certainly with the slide, that we are right now, we have accumulated more of the people's money in the state government's bank account than we have in the last 20 years. Has there ever been $2 billion or more in the budget reserve or cash flow account in the history of the state?
Ms. Ratan.
Madam Chair and Representative, no, there has not. The budget reserve prior to 2015, I believe, was capped at a much lower number, and there was a new policy put in place to make the reserve cap raise up to 5%. Is it 5%?
Yeah. Or 4.9 now.
4.9% of total revenues into the general fund. And that's to protect against an economic downturn.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Budget Director Ratan. That's what I thought. Can you remind us where we are at and what trajectory we are on? We know the November forecast is when any projected surplus, one-third of it goes again into this state government bank account. And this is the people's money being dumped into there. The question is, if we have a surplus next year, according to law, is there going to be even more money added on the nearly $2.5 billion of the people's money?
Ms. Ratan.
Madam Chair and Representative, we are not yet at the cap. The cap, I believe, is 2.2 in just the reserve
yeah.
Currently. So 2.2 billion. So if we reached the cap, then it would no longer continue to be deposited into the reserve.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Budget Director. So members, we have the largest budget reserve and cash flow collection of the people's money here in state government piled in the history of our state, and we have state law written now that if there is a projected over-collection of the people's money planned again as we look at the November forecast next year, even more of the people's money is going to be forced into that pile for the state to hold on to. And I don't know if this is – certainly it's good policy for the health of government, but at what point do we start to think about the people and their money that is being put into this and held and taken from their paychecks and their businesses and their ability to pay their bills and grow their businesses when government is doing so very, very well? A government is so fat – and it appears the government's going to get fatter unless we change directions. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Chair.
Representative Hertas.
Well, thank you, Chair Carlson. And my question also is about the budget reserve. Certainly, as we continue to grow the general fund budget, the requirement is that the budget reserve has to grow in proportion to that 5%. So this number potentially keeps growing as we are spending. But with respect to the size of the current budget reserve, and somewhat like the school trust fund, which is invested and returns on that investment are distributed to the schools, my question relates to, and I can't recall in my time here ever seeing any accounting of whether or not these funds are invested, even if on a short-term basis, and where is the revenue from that return on investment going to? Is it being deposited into the general fund? Is it showing up as other income, or should it not be deposited directly into this budget reserve account?
Mr. Prince.
Mr. Chair and representative members of the committee. So the reserve account operates on behalf of the people of Minnesota, just like you'd run any business or you run your own family finances, is to make sure when things go wrong, you can step in and provide those programs and those monies when people most need it. So the reason for the reserve is to protect those programs and people who depend on those programs when the revenues drop precipitously during an economic downturn. The analysis of deciding how much goes into the reserve fund has been based on a very sophisticated model. Actually, it's been touted as one of the smartest fiscal policies around the country for figuring out how much money should be in a reserve, because I agree there's a debate about what is that right amount. We've made that decision based upon a studied analysis. I think the reason that we've done so is to make sure that we can withstand a typical economic downturn that might arise. The money that's actually in the general fund and that's deposited, not just for the general fund, but all funds, is managed by the State Board of Investment. So what happens, for example, the pension accounts, pension funds, are all managed by the State Board of Investment, but also so are the available cash amounts that are in the general fund. Some of them are invested on short-term money because we need to have the availability of the funds, but that is all handled through the State Board of Investment. We can happy to get that information for you about the returns that they receive, but that's all managed through one overall account system.
Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, well, you explained how it's invested. My question was, any returns on that money, where does it go?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that money is all within the whatever fund it's in. So, for example, in the pension funds, if there's a return on those funds, it stays within those pension funds. For the general fund, the short-term return is retained in the general fund itself.
And, Mr. Chair?
Representative Hertas.
One final question. So is there, in your judgment, any time in the near future with the size of this fund that we could suffice some of our own short-term borrowing and the state of Minnesota could pay itself back with interest rather than dumping interest into the private market?
Mr. Franz.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think the current thinking has been to use the private market whenever available, for especially when you have a large billions and billions of dollars of money. The idea is to use the private market to make those returns and to provide some return to the general fund or to the pension fund. So certainly there are other ways to do it, other models to do it, and I certainly think that'd be an appropriate discussion to have with the State Board of Investment if they wanted to change their investment model.
Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll try to be really quick. I have to say, I'm glad that we have a smart budget reserve philosophy in our state. I can tell you, my wife and I over the weekend we were paying our bills, and you know, we do everything we can to put money away in savings. In addition to that, we also, quite frankly, try to keep some cushion somewhere because every once in a while something's going to happen. And it could create a crisis in my household. And so I think we've used a very common sense approach in the state not to let the inevitable occasional crises wind up hurting the people of Minnesota. But my questions very quickly are on the labor market issues. I was really intrigued by, and perhaps it's a question to our state economist, I was really intrigued by the quick presentation of what of the argument of a slow labor market growth being a big player that's having an impact on our macro budget economics here. And so, you know, there's tight labor market conditions that are happening. You talked about, you know, demographics, mostly about age, that drive that. I'm just curious very quickly, you know, whether that is it seems to me that's a reality across the board, because we're talking about macro economics here, but my guess is that there are probably particular sectors that are harshly impacted that have perhaps an outsized impact, you know, on our budget numbers. So I wonder if you could just very quickly tell us a little bit more about what those might be and maybe say a little bit about how we've tried to compensate for that in recent years.
Colin Mikitas.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so that you asked about specific sectors that might be affected by the tight labor market. So sectors where, so what happens when there's a tight labor market is that you would expect employers to invest in productivity-enhancing techniques, procedures, equipment, in order to get more out of the workers that they have, so they're more they can produce more. And in some sectors, it's really hard to do that because you need that the human touch. You need an actual person there. So one of the areas that I know is facing challenges with regard to the tight labor market is healthcare and healthcare services, personal care services in particular. In looking at the open positions across industries, there are high levels of open positions in construction, and that's another industry where it's one of the limitations on and a cost driver in terms of the construction industry in Minnesota is the not having as many people looking for jobs right now as there has been. So what are the things that can alleviate this? One of the bright spots, and I think I mentioned this last time I was here, but we have additional information on this, is one of the bright spots in our labor market is that Minnesota, for over the last 15 years, has annually lost people to other states, meaning that our net domestic in-migration was negative. Just looking at people coming into Minnesota from other states versus people leaving Minnesota to other states. But that reversed in 17, and we had positive net in-migration in 2017. I mentioned that in my November presentation, but we now have information that was also true in 18. So that's positive for us. What happened over those 15 years when that net immigration, domestic immigration was negative, is that we still had positive net immigration because our international net immigration made up for that. And so these are key factors in what's happening going forward for Minnesota and our labor market, is that employers are looking to ways to enhance the productivity of the workers they do have. They are looking to populations that they may have overlooked before and trying to lower barriers. We have two years of data of people on net coming to Minnesota from other states. And international net immigration remains an important factor in our ability to thrive going forward.
Representative Mariano.
Mr. Chair, just very quickly, thank you for that. And there's much more to dive into there. But it does seem that part of that message, particularly when it comes to the private sector, that's obviously doing everything it can to invest in, alternative technologies and, alternative processes for efficiency. It seems to me that those have limitations, and I think that's precisely where our state government steps in to be able to partner with our private sector so that those investments there and the people's public investments, can create much more opportunities. And I say it only because I don't want us to rush into thinking that we have to stop doing that kind of work as we're adjusting, settling in and realizing, how the forecast has shifted. That has a tendency to create, a pessimistic attitude, and it seems to me that this state is full of powerful practices that allow us to remain optimistic. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, and I'm going to refer to Representative Hornstein for a brief moment in case people start leaving in the next minute or two to make an announcement relative to the meeting tomorrow night, and then I'll revert back, even though now we've got about 2 minutes, to Marquardt, Davids, and Vogel. But Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would just want to reiterate what I said earlier, that members can make their choices based on priorities, but I did want to announce at the Chair's request that we're hearing two bills tomorrow night. Neither of them will take action on, as has been the case at these field hearings, so there won't be votes tomorrow night. So I wanted to let the committee know that, and I appreciate Representative Torkelson's concerns, but we've had very successful hearings with a lot of input from the public, and I think that's an important part of our work.
Okay, and then the Chair has an announcement. Remember that tomorrow night, just to at the bottom of our agenda, it says that we're going to meet in room 120. Our intent is to try to find a different room to
tomorrow night, so watch for that announcement. Okay, I'm going to just quickly take our two tax people, the current chair, the previous chair, and then Representative Vogel. And if everybody can be brief, because we're right now at the time of adjournment, Representative Marquardt.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and I will be brief. I just think we have to use caution when we speculate on how the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act is going to impact migration or other things. There are so many movable parts that we just don't know. But what we do know is reflected in the forecast. I mean, we hear a lot always about the out-migration of high-income folks, but yet in the report, the data that we actually have and that we know is that income tax, without any law changes, is going to increase from this biennium to the next by 8.3%, which is more than sales tax, the corporate tax rate will increase. And as just mentioned by the chief economist, in the last 2 years, we've actually had an increase in net domestic migration. That means people moving in from other states versus those that are moving out. And it was about almost 8,000 in 2017 and about 6,900 this past year. So, you know, when we talk about migration, all these things, there's a lot of speculation. You hear a lot of anecdotal evidence, but you know, you've got to come back and also look at the data also.
Okay, thank you. And Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I totally agree with Chair Marquardt. We do need to look at the data, and I hope you'll look at a report today. The data from Bloomberg, dated 3-4 of 2019, that's today, the title is High Tax States Make It Hard for the Rich to Leave Because They Are Fleeing. They are leaving the state, especially New York and California. They are going, and I have not just anecdotal evidence, I have actual evidence. But please read that article and you see how serious this is.
Okay, Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just clarification, the budget forecast talked a lot about the lower withholding. How are estimated tax payments? Is it all withholding, or is some of it that deficiency shared with estimateds?
Dr. Kalamitakidis.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so we've had, as you said, lower than forecast withholding payments early this year, but at the end of last year, so the fourth quarter estimated payments for last year were also lower than forecast and lower than the prior year.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just wondering about the relative importance. In other words, the dollars. Mm-hmm. What are you forecasting there relative to withholding shortages and estimated shortages? Because I would assume that's the majority of the revenue that comes in on individual income tax.
Dr. Kalamitakidis.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative, the negative variance, meaning the shortfall of revenues in withholding, is less than the shortfall in estimated payments. Estimated payments is a bigger part of the story.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I won't belabor it, but it would be nice if those figures could maybe be relayed to us as far as the exact amounts that we're looking at, relative difference between withholding and estimated. Thank you.
Just went up, Dr. Coleman.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. So the current fiscal year to date numbers are on page 72 of the forecast book. So that shows those negative variances. The negative variance in withholding fiscal year to date is $50 million. The negative variance in what we call declarations, and that's those estimated payments, is $318 million.
Okay, I'd like to thank Commissioner Franz and Dr. Kalamitakidis and Budget Director Raton. I suspect at various times the three of you will be back. But in the meantime, we will be meeting tomorrow evening, and the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.